Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. You're listening to 90.7 WFAE Charlotte and 90.3 WFHE Hickory. I'm Mark Rumsey. This is special coverage from WFAE of continuing developments in the story surrounding this week's fatal police shooting of 43-year-old Keith Scott in North Charlotte. Major new development today is the surfacing of a video which went to several major news organizations from the family of Keith Scott. Cell phone video said to be shot by Keith Scott's wife at the scene of that fatal shooting on Tuesday. We're going to be talking about what we do and don't know from that video and what it may mean for this investigation and this case going forward. I'm Mark Rumsey, joined here in our studio this afternoon by WFAE reporters Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn, also by Professor Jason Huber. He teaches civil procedure and directs the Charlotte School of Law's Civil Rights Clinic. So to the three of you, if you'll stand by for just a second, I'd like to, first of all, go right to the first clip of this video. This is a portion of a video that runs about 2 minutes and 13 seconds that went to a number of news organizations, again, as I said today, from the family of Keith Scott. We'll hear the other segments in a little bit, but let's begin with this first 40 seconds or so of what is heard during that cell phone recording.
Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. He has no weapon. He has no weapon. Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. He didn't do anything. He doesn't have a gun. He has a TBI. He's not going to do anything to you guys. He just took his medicine. Keith, don't let them break the windows. Come on out the car.
So as we begin this special coverage during All Things Considered here on WFAE, again, Mark Rumsey here joined by Tom Bullock, Gwendolyn Glenn from our WFAE news staff, also Professor Jason Huber from the Charlotte School of Law. There's a lot to talk about just from that first 40 seconds or so of video this afternoon. Tom, give us the best feel that we can for what we're hearing.
All right. Well, the first thing to note is I'm glad that we're breaking this down into segments for a simple reason. This video leads to a lot of questions. If you're looking for clear answers, this is not going to be a device to bring clear answers. And I'm sure we'll hear the entirety of the clip later on. But what we're hearing there first and foremost is Rakia Scott. She's the 20-year, she was married to Keith Lamont Scott for 20 years. They were still married, and she is on scene at the shooting. This is before the shooting takes place. It was recorded on a cell phone, and it's pretty, you know, complicated to try to figure out what's going on. As she's standing there initially, you can see a blue Ford Explorer with a door open, a police cruiser pulls up, and what you end up seeing is you hear her trying to talk to her husband. And that's where even more questions begin, because the first thing that I think we should talk about is TBI. That stands for traumatic brain injury. And I know, Gwendolyn, that's something you've been looking at.
Yes, they talked about that earlier, her attorneys, that he had been in an accident about a year ago and that he had very severe bodily injuries and that he had TBI. And also they talked about in this particular video, you could hear her saying he just took medication and that he's not armed, he's not going to hurt anybody. But that is something that they said led to him being qualified as disabled.
And the key thing with TBI, there are differing ranges of traumatic brain injury. I'm used to cover Iraq and Afghanistan. I know a lot of vets. This is something that people are probably most familiar with when it comes to explosions or IEDs, or if you're a football fan, you know, concussions, those kinds of things. What TBI can do, depending on severity and depending on medication, is it can lead to confusion. It can lead to trying to understand exactly what is going on, not knowing what's going on. Now, we don't know the level of severity of this injury for Mr. Scott. We do not yet know what medications he was on. We do not yet know exactly what effect that medication would have. But you can clearly hear his wife trying to alert the officers as they are saying, put down the gun, that he has a TBI. The other thing that's important to note at this point is we cannot see Keith Lamont Scott at all in the footage. And you can repeatedly hear police officers yelling to put down the gun. We cannot see Mr. Scott. We don't know what he was holding. His family has long said it was not a gun. Clearly, the officers at that point believed it. They're saying it again and again. So exactly what Mr. Scott was doing at this point, we still don't know.
And we're just hearing the wife saying that he does not have a gun, and she's pleading with police and with her husband, because at one point we hear her saying, get out of the vehicle, get out of the vehicle. She's telling police, he's not going to harm you. He's just taking medication. But again, as Tom says, there are a lot of questions. And from seeing this video, which of course moves about a lot and is very shaky at times, it goes off the scene and it's from a particular angle. There are shadows there. So it's left a lot of questions.
All right. I want to go ahead and let us hear more of that 2 minute or so video. We had it broken down into segments, but we want to hear more of what's there. So here comes sort of the middle section of that audio from the cell phone that was video that was released today.
Keith, don't let them break the windows. Come on out the car. Keith, don't do it. Keith, get out the car. Keith, don't you do it. Don't you do it. Keith, don't you do it. Did you shoot him? Did you shoot him? Did you shoot him? He better not be dead. He better not be dead. I know that much. I know that much. He better not be dead. I'm not gonna come near you. I'm gonna record though. I'm not coming near you. I'm gonna record though. He better be alive, because I'm coming. You better be alive. How about that?
So this is obviously the most disturbing part of the video, with what, by all indications, we're hearing gunshots taking place there, along with the emotion of the woman making the video, who we believe to be the wife of 43-year-old Keith Scott. Again, a lot to try to take in with that segment of the video. Gwendolyn, what are you hearing there?
Well, again, more questions, because when you hear her saying, don't do it, don't do it, we don't know if she's talking to her husband or if she's talking to the police, because she doesn't call a name. We do hear her telling him to get out of the vehicle, but when she says that, we don't know if she's telling the police not to shoot him, because she's said to them, he doesn't have a gun, he's not going to hurt you, but we don't know who she's talking to at that point when she says that.
There is one bit of corroborating evidence here with this video and the official account that CMPD has actually put out for quite some time now. They have said from the beginning that Mr. Scott was in his car, and then they say he got back, you know, got out, got back in the car. What's interesting with this video is from the beginning of it, you see the passenger door open in the car. So there is, it's reasonable to believe that Mr. Scott had gotten out of the car. But to hear her say, just come out of the car, don't do it, it could be to an officer, it could be to her husband. Again, the important thing here, and it's very important we say what we do and do not know, we still cannot see Keith Lamont Scott at any time. So we don't know exactly what he's doing. And what's interesting here, and it is important to note, he may or may not have had a gun, and that itself, in North Carolina, it's important to remember, this is, in fact, an open carry state, which means it's actually legal for someone to have a gun in public, and this was a public space.
Well, there are obviously many legal points to be analyzed in a situation like this. We have in the studio with us this afternoon Professor Jason Huber from the Charlotte School of Law. Professor Huber, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And a reminder that you are listening to special All Things Considered coverage here on 90.7 WFAE with new developments today regarding the fatal shooting of Keith Scott this week. Professor Huber, first of all, just these first two segments of the video that you, I know, have spent quite a bit of time already today looking at them repeatedly, right?
Correct, sir.
And what, in addition to what Gwendolyn and Tom have shared, does anything else stand out to you?
Quite a few things stand out. Most importantly, though, when you watch the video from a Fourth Amendment perspective in attempting to determine whether or not the use of force was reasonable, you become very frustrated because of what the video does not show you. And when you're looking at deadly force from a Fourth Amendment perspective and reasonableness, essentially there have to be objective facts that would lead an objectively reasonable police officer to believe that the individual posed an imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death to the officer or to somebody else. And the video simply just does not answer that question. In fact, it doesn't tell us one way or another. We don't see the circumstances that drew the police officer's attention to Mr. Scott in the first place. We never see Mr. Scott, as had already been pointed out. We can't see on the inside of the vehicle to understand what it was that the police officer saw that led them to, say, drop the gun. We don't see what happened immediately preceding the shot. And without those facts, it is very difficult to make a determination concerning whether or not the deadly use of force was or was not reasonable and therefore did or did not violate Mr. Scott's Fourth Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm. And what you're describing there on the imminent threat and the use of deadly force, am I correct that those same rules apply across the board in North Carolina, whether we're talking about a law enforcement officer being involved or not?
Yeah, the analysis is slightly different, but essentially that's correct. Mm-hmm. Now, concerning the point that in North Carolina it is an open carry state, that is correct. And there have been some opinions in the Fourth Circuit, at least one recently, that the court excluded evidence when police officers stopped somebody because they saw an individual that had a gun. In other words, stopping and frisking and obtaining evidence violated that person's Fourth Amendment rights. There's a big difference, though, between having a gun and brandishing a weapon or pointing a weapon. And again, the video just does not answer that question.
And that's a really important point to make, because one of the things that you've heard from both Mayor Jennifer Roberts and CMPD Chief Kerr Putney is we know of two other videos that are out there. One is a dash cam, one is a body camera. That was confirmed today that those are the two videos that both Jennifer Roberts and Kerr Putney have seen, and both have said that it doesn't answer all these questions. That I believe Kerr Putney said yesterday that he couldn't tell it, where the gun was. He couldn't tell if it was pointed at the officers. He continues to say that Mr. Scott had a gun. He says in totality, all of the evidence corroborates what the officers, and there were four of them on the scene, said. But he says the video alone is not a panacea and that there are still a lot of questions about the video. In fact, the family themselves, the Scott family themselves, have said that the video has some questions, leaves them with questions.
Right.
Yes, that's what when I attended a press conference at the government center, that was one thing he said. It was not conclusive that he was pointing the gun, and the family is saying he was not posing a threat to police officers. So that is something that we were not able to tell from this video. And also during the press conference, the police chief was asked, in terms of when your officers approach someone with a gun, what are they trained to do? And he was not very specific beyond saying that they are to obey the law and go by what is legal and make sure that someone has a gun legally. But he was not very specific.
Right. Professor Huber, did you have?
Yeah, there's an additional wrinkle in the analysis concerning whether or not there was, in fact, a gun. I think the actual question is whether or not, if there was not a gun, were the police officers reasonably mistaken in thinking there was a gun? And that's a separate analysis in and of itself that, again, the videotape doesn't answer.
In a moment, we're going to bring in another guest who certainly has a lot of perspective on this from the law enforcement angle, and that is former Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief Darrell Stevens. He's now with the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association. We'll get to Chief Stevens in just a moment. I want to go ahead and play the third clip of this audio from the cell phone video recording that was released today. So this is after the gunshots are heard, and this is sort of how the two-minute video segment finishes up is what we'll be hearing next.
Yes, we're over here at 9453 Lexington Court. These are the police officers that shot my husband, and he better live. He better live. Because he didn't do nothing to them. He good. Ain't nobody touch nobody, so they all good. I know he better live. I know he better live. How about that? I'm not coming to you guys, but he better live. He better live. Y'all hear this and you see this, right? He better live. He better live. I swear he better live.
again, the emotion, and just take would like to take a moment just to recognize just the new world that we're in hearing and witnessing this kind of thing, be it visually or audibly, taking us very close to a very, very serious situation in the lives of multiple people. And so just want to recognize that. We'll talk with Chief Daryl Stevens in a moment. When I first heard that portion of the video, I thought perhaps that she was calling 911, but I don't think so. I think she was just narrating what was happening there on the scene. Before we go to Chief Stevens, Tom, Gwendolyn, any other observations on that clip of audio?
This is the segment of this is the segment of the video that's going to get the most scrutiny, because this is the segment of the video where you see what appears to be one or two items that either are thrown or fall to the ground. And I think I just know from, you know, what looking at the reaction on social media that a lot of people are automatically jumping to the conclusion that the police were up to something they shouldn't have been. And this is also the first time in the video that you see Mr. Scott. He's lying on the ground. You see him basically the soles of his shoes and his legs. And you see almost immediately two officers who are performing CPR on him. And this – I think we should go ahead and bring in the guest, because this is the key part.
And I'm glad you mentioned the obvious point there that we're hearing the audio. There is video that goes with this, which is posted on our website, WFAE.org. This is video released by the family and their attorneys today of family of Keith Scott, who was fatally shot by a CMPD officer on Tuesday. And you're listening to special All Things Considered coverage on 90.7 WFAE. I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by our reporters Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn, also by Professor Jason Huber from the Charlotte School of Law. And now bringing in by phone Daryl Stevens, former Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief, now Director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Mr. Stevens, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Good to hear your voice, and thank
good
you so much
you again as well.
for joining us on a difficult afternoon at the end of a difficult week here in Charlotte. And for a former Charlotte-Mecklenburg police chief, I can only imagine that it's sort of a profound moment or week for you as well.
It has been indeed. Seen some things that I think we always knew was possible to take place in any urban city and environment, and particularly over the past 2 years with all of the issues involving confidence and trust in police and the visibility of police shootings that we've never, ever seen before. Just the raw emotion that that is involved with the video that Mr. Scott's wife or attorneys released today, I think puts you on scene in the chaotic seconds and moments that take place during these encounters. And we've seen more and more of those over the past couple of years. And so it brings people right into the scene. But as you all have said on a number of occasions, the footage that we see, the dialogue, certainly raises many, many questions that have not been answered yet.
Chief Stevens, when you have seen this video today, in addition to sensing and reacting to that emotional element of it, in a factual sense, does anything jump out at you?
Well, what jumps out is, and the reporters and attorney have already focused on this. We do not see Mr. Scott. We see these images of something being dropped. We hear the constant repeat of "drop the gun, drop the gun, drop the gun," and then Mrs. Scott, who she's talking to, is not entirely clear, particularly when she's talking about "don't do it." And so those are all Those are all questions that are there. It would be very unusual for a police officer to, and that we heard more than once, make those statements if they did not believe that they were facing a person with a firearm.
Chief Darrell Stevens, we have in the studio, as I mentioned, our reporters Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn, along with Professor Jason Huber from the Charlotte School of Law. So I'll invite them to jump in here with questions for you as well. Tom?
Chief Stevens, it's Tom Bullock. I want to focus really on this, what is going to be the key image or images from this video, which are what is dropped. It's not clear exactly what it is. This is after Mr. Scott has already been shot. He's on the ground. There are two police officers who are performing CPR. One of them gets up to walk over to the cruiser. We don't know why. And then the only African-American officer on the scene, who is clearly Brentley Vinson, who is the officer reportedly who fired the fatal shot, he looks to drop two things, and I'm sure, like the rest of Charlotte and a lot of people in the country, you've seen that segment. What do you think is happening?
I can't explain what's happening. I have no idea. The obvious assumption that a lot of people will make is they have dropped a gun. But the question would be why? I mean, why would they do that if they believed that there was a gun there to begin with? The police department is certainly going to put more pressure on Chief Putney and the SBI, who's investigating this, to show the video that they have. But I think from every statement that I've heard anyone make who's seen those videos is that that those bring in the same kinds of questions that the one that we're seeing today bring in. No clarity at all, no certainty at all as to what has happened. And I think that's partly why they are saying, give us a chance to complete this investigation and talk to the witnesses and use whatever physical evidence that they're able to recover at the scene to help explain in greater clarity what happened during this interaction.
Incidentally, and of course, the calls have been increasing for the public release of the dash and body cam videos. And today, both Mayor Roberts and Chief Kerr Putney earlier today indicated that it would come at the appropriate time, which was a little more forthcoming sounding than what we'd heard before. And a new statement just coming in right now from Mayor Jennifer Roberts. She says, "I respect the investigative process and I want to ensure the integrity of the independent investigation of the State Bureau of Investigation. I urge it, that is the Bureau, to use every resource at its disposal to get this done, and the key phrase here, and release the information to the public as quickly as possible." So the statements are getting stronger, even amongst the officials involved here. Seems to be moving toward that release at whatever time those decisions are actually made.
I'm sure that they are going to be pursuing this with a great deal of energy and want to be in a position to share with the public everything that that they know. The body cam and cameras all over the place have produced this sense that if we have that and we can just see it, then that's going to bring clarity to these situations. And with very few exceptions, what the videos do, it does give you more insight, but it also doesn't provide the clear indication whether the shooting was justified or it was not. It requires the rest of the information that comes along with a complete investigation.
And I know right now that the State Bureau of Investigation is over the case now, and the chief said he can't release any more information. And that's what I was going to ask you. With this new video being released by the wife of Mr. Scott, do you think they should release what they have quicker, so I guess more the public can get more of a comparison? And you also have the video from the daughter when this happened, where she put a live Facebook video on in which she made accusations that her father, a gun was being planted on her father. Mm-hmm. So you have all of those kinds of rumors and speculation and things going on. Do you think that makes it time for those videos to be released so there can be more of a comparison for the public and others?
Well, it's difficult. It certainly puts the SBI and puts greater pressure on them to complete their investigation as quickly as possible. Whether they will make a determination to go ahead and release the video or not, I can't say. It's their investigation. Typically, I don't think they would do that. But this is not a typical situation. It's not typical for the SBI to come in and do these investigations in Charlotte. But they are in this circumstance, I think, with the hope of being able to provide a greater sense of an independent investigation in the situation. But if you look at the video that you have now, and you know what little you know about the other videos, they're saying that there's lack of clarity, or there's no ability to come to a clear conclusion about whether Mr. Scott was armed or pointing the gun. I believe I've heard them say that on several occasions. So what that does is just add to the fuel a lot more questions that there's no clear answers to. It's tragic that we're not able to enjoy the confidence of the public to the extent that it requires to look into these things and be more precise about what we say and when we say it.
Chief Stevens, I believe Professor Jason Huber with the Charlotte School of Law is with us here in the studio, has a question for you as well.
Chief Stevens, I want to follow up on the comment you just made about confidence that the community may or may not have in the police department, and specifically ask you about how events like these are going to impact community policing in the future. Because as I've investigated community policing and looked into these different issues, it's clear that trust is the cornerstone to community policing. And how do these incidents impact the ability of the police department to move forward and to engage in community policing and solve crimes based on the trust and confidence that the community has in the department? And if you think it's going to detrimentally impact their ability, then how would you as chief cure that?
Mr. Huber, they have a major impact on that. And it's not just that happening in your community. Whatever happens across the country is people see that in whatever their views are about police officers, or to some extent may be influenced by events, even those that do not occur in your community. So whenever these happen, whenever there's a shooting and there's lots of questions about whether it was justified, whether the police should have done that or not, it does have an impact on the trust and confidence. And the only way for police to be able to rebuild that first is to be as open and transparent as they possibly can whenever they can about these incidents. And we've seen big changes in the way police have operated. And body cameras is new technology. Policies are still forming. Laws have not caught up with to help form those policies. And so there's a lot of different approaches to this from one part of the country to the other. But part of rebuilding is being as open, as honest you can, and remembering that those relationships are built one contact at a time. Every interaction that a police officer has with every citizen makes a difference in terms of what the trust and confidence level is. And it's being available. I know the CMPD over the past, ever since the Jonathan Farrell, and even before that, but since the Jonathan Farrell tragedy that took place, the Cops and Barbers program, for example, was developed to try to enhance that dialogue. And the department for years have had police officers that participate in every community meeting that takes place in neighborhoods, and those things help. Big shooting like this, a controversy like this, is a setback for us all.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Things Considered on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mark Rumsey. This is special coverage this afternoon of events and developments surrounding this week's fatal police shooting of Keith Scott. We've been talking by phone with former Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief Daryl Stevens. He's now director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Chief Stevens, I'll let you go in just a moment here. I'm sure it's a busy day for you. I appreciate your time. I wanted to close out on that point about the videos by asking you, from your perspective, if you think a few years from now or maybe sooner, with the proliferation of so much homemade and cell phone video, that the question of releasing the police videos will become moot, that there won't be any discussion about whether to release them quickly.
I doubt that that will happen. My guess, I mean, it may be that they're so prolific that the police videos won't even be relevant because of all of the other footage that is out there. But I sincerely doubt that will happen. There's so much emphasis being placed on what is shown and what's not shown in the video that people forget the forensic science that's involved in conducting an investigation. They're not remembering that there's other people that see things that take place, and we all are beginning to understand the challenges with eyewitnesses and what they remember about what they see. But still, that's a part, that's one piece of building a picture of what happened, so that you can understand it from everyone's angle and perspective. And so my guess is that they may release it quicker, and that'll help maybe create some resolution in people's minds, maybe raise more questions, but the final conclusion or the final outcome on the decisions as to whether or not they were justified or not are going to come with the full package of all of the evidence that you have to be able to draw your conclusions.
Chief Stevens, thanks so much for joining us for this discussion this afternoon. We appreciate your time.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Daryl Stevens, former Charlotte-Mecklenburg police chief, now director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. City officials, of course, are continuing to watch all of these developments as they're changing rapidly from day to day. And one of the individuals that we've been keeping in touch with over the past several days is Charlotte's Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles. And she's joining us now also to weigh in on these newest developments. There's a new development this afternoon with the public release of a video, cell phone video, recorded by the wife of Keith Scott, who was shot and killed by a CMPD officer earlier this week. Have you seen that new video?
I have seen the video. It's painful, disturbing, very graphic. The idea of hearing those gunshots and seeing Mr. Scott there is terribly difficult to watch. And we're watching it over and over on national television, local television, and hearing it on outlets like WFAE.
Based on the information that we've known up to this point, is there anything that you see or hear in the video, the cell phone video today, that surprises you?
I am not surprised by Mrs. Scott's reaction to that very, very quick encounter. I think that she was reacting as any woman would, with her husband being surrounded by the police officers. She certainly, I just want to say that I think Mrs. Scott has given us an opportunity to see how she felt. I think by releasing the video, she had a right, because she's got to deal and address her husband's legacy and memory.
Yes, and about the what actual facts can or can't be derived from the video, is there anything there that you think clarifies anything, or does this add to the confusion?
I don't think it adds to the confusion. I think it actually adds to the body of evidence that has to be considered in addressing this case. As you know, this morning the chief and the mayor said that this was going to be turned over to the State Bureau of Investigation. That was one of the things the community called for, an independent investigation, and we worked to do that, to make that happen, hoping that that would increase trust in what we were doing locally. I think that this video is just another mechanism to be weighed and to get to the evidence in this area. Mark, the thing that I am most concerned about is I hope that everyone believes everyone wants to get to the truth, and we need to get every part of what people are saying and doing in order to do that.
This video from the family comes as the calls are intensifying for CMPD to release the official, the police body cam and dash cam videos of Tuesday's shooting. The police chief is now saying more or less it's a matter of time, you know, the right timing for that release. When would you like to see those videos released?
I like to see the video released as soon as possible. But again, going back, we asked the state to take this so that we could have some distance so that we could continue to build trust. And now they're going to have to look at it, and they'll make that decision as a part of their investigation.
Councilwoman Lyles, how are you feeling about going into the weekend? We've had three nights of protests. Some have been more or less violent than others. What is your anticipation as we reach the weekend?
I have always supported the ability for people to protest, and what we need to do is make sure that every protester is safe, every person in that group of protesters, all the way to the crowd of protesters are safe. And so Charlotte is moving forward with protection so that people can exercise their rights. So our goal is that we have peace, we have calm, but also when we have protesting, to make sure that it's safe.
A phrase that's been used in recent days has been business as usual for Charlotte through this crisis for the community. Do you feel that the weekend should be business as usual, or what's your recommendation on that?
I wouldn't ever use the phrase business as usual. This is not business as usual. It is not something that we can say that is routine for us. This is exceptional. You know, we've had a break here, a crack in our community fabric. I don't know how to fill it right now, but it is not business as usual. We've got to recognize we've had some weaknesses. Those weaknesses have become faults, and those faults are becoming wider. So, no, I can't say business as usual, and I know that's something that may not be politically correct for me to say. But I care so much about this community that I'm willing to recognize where those deep differences are, where there's disenfranchisement, where there's disengagement, and where we've had decline. So it isn't business as usual for me. It is, how do we move forward? How do we open our eyes to these differences, and what are we going to do next?
And what are you, along with other city officials that you're in contact with, doing to monitor whatever information is available to you about how things may unfold over the weekend in terms of any additional protest or demonstration activity in Charlotte?
I think one of the things that we're doing is relying on our community to take the information that we can get out as quickly as possible, to look at that information and know that we are making those decisions with one primary value, which is keeping everyone in a safe position. And we would like to, we have the curfew, we have the football game, we have a number of things that we are looking at, and every decision that we make it with that one value of keeping our city safe. And we want those techniques and tactics that we're using to be known, and so we're continuing to push out communication about everything so that people can make decisions about how they go to work and where what they're doing, how they're going to have their weekends planned, and whether it's for play or work, and do that in a way that they're informed.
The football game planned on Sunday at Bank of America Stadium obviously brings a large number of people into the uptown area. Are you comfortable with that event happening on Sunday?
I can't speak to that. I think that that is something that between the NFL, the Charlotte Police Department, and our partners with the State Highway Patrol and our National Guard, those decisions will have to be made in the time that gets closer to the game, and that is something we will look to our enforcement community to make a decision.
Charlotte Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's 20 minutes to 5. You're listening to a special edition of All Things Considered here on 90.7 WFAE. This Friday afternoon, I'm Mark Rumsey with special coverage surrounding the fatal police shooting this week of Keith Scott in Charlotte and developments that have ensued in the past 3 days, including the release today by the family of Mr. Scott of a video shot by the shooting victim's wife there on the scene in North Charlotte on Tuesday afternoon. We're going to play one clip of that two-minute or so video, the beginning of that video that was released to a number of media organizations today.
Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. He has no weapon. He has no weapon. Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. He didn't do anything. He doesn't have a gun. He has a TBI. He's not going to do anything to you guys. He just took his medicine. Keith, don't let them break the windows. Come on out the car.
Difficult video and audio to take in. This is raw video that was released by the family of Keith Scott this afternoon. Much to talk about. We've been discussing over the past hour and we'll continue to analyze. But right now we want to focus on what you heard right there towards the end of the woman identified as Keith Scott's wife trying to tell police officers on the scene on Tuesday that her husband, Mr. Scott, had TBI. We understand that to be traumatic brain injury, the reference to that. That raises a whole another set of questions. And to help us address some of those questions, we're joined by phone now by retired Brigadier General Stephen Zenicus. Dr. Zenicus was an Army psychiatrist for 28 years. General Zenicus, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, good to be here. Thank you for calling.
And I'm assuming that you have seen this two-minute video that is going out via many media outlets today.
No, I haven't seen it. So this is my first time even know that it's out.
I understand. Okay. Were you able to hear the segment that we just played on the air here?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So what we'd love to explore with you for a few minutes here is traumatic brain injury, because obviously there's going to be a lot of interest in how that condition could play into a situation involving police and civilian, as we had here with the fatal shooting in Charlotte this week. What should we be taking into account as we think about traumatic brain injury in a situation like this?
Well, we should be asking about what's the severity of the injury, because it really does vary. How many times the person was injured, because that also makes a difference. Because over time, a person can get hit in the head, or like many of our soldiers and veterans who have been in combat, exposed to blast concussions that cause microscopic injuries of the nerves in the brain. And that those can accumulate over time, and people will have problems when it comes to their thinking. They'll have short-term memory. They'll have problems when it comes to concentrating, paying attention, controlling their emotions, and it really complicates their life in all sorts of different ways. It sounded from this particular tape that he had also just taking medicine, which can help with many of the symptoms, but it can also cause problems when it comes to thinking and mood. So you know, each case is different, and you have to really dive into it and get all the details with each one of these individuals.
General Zenicus, can you say anything more about typical problems you referred to with thinking and mood that the medication for traumatic brain injury might prompt?
Well, a lot of the individuals who've had concussions really have find themselves being very irritable at times. They can't control, they can't suppress either the anger that they're feeling or other strong emotions, and they don't know how to manage it, and they'll get out of control. Their problems in thinking that can occur at the same time is they don't have as much capacity to exercise judgment. And they don't really, in a situation that particularly is very emotional, they don't know how to react to it. And they don't know, figure out, well, here's what I need to do to maybe calm myself down or react in a way that's not going to make the situation worse. And they get, in the moment, they can get really confused.
General Zenicus, I'm in the studio here with some colleagues, including our reporter, Gwendolyn Glenn. Gwendolyn, go ahead.
Specifically, though, in terms of the medication, you talked about some of the symptoms that people who suffer from TBI have, but can you talk specifically about how medications that they take could affect them? Because the wife said that he had just taken medication.
Well, it depends on they have various symptoms. Like one of the most common symptoms is headaches. And so there's all sorts of painkillers that that are prescribed and these people take because the headaches are like migraines. So that is when they take one of those medications, then they can feel more confused and can also find themselves not able to control their emotions because they really kind of get abundant in a way. Sometimes they'll have other problems and just feeling anxious all the time because it's they're feeling like they can't manage the situation, and there's a variety of medications that are prescribed for that, and they help, but also it causes problems in thinking because as you try and control the anxiety or feeling the tension, sometimes people are thinking slower, they don't know how to figure out what's going on around them, and again, kind of what is the best thing to do, and it's the most appropriate thing to do in the situation.
All right. Retired Brigadier General Stephen Zenicus, your expertise is helpful here in Charlotte today. So thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Glad to help. Thanks.
It's about 13 minutes before 5, and this is All Things Considered on 90.7 WFAE. Our reporter David Borax is covering another angle of this developing story today, and he'll be joining us in just a second. Dr. Jason Huber from the Charlotte School of Law is with us also, and I believe that based on the conversation there with General Zenicus, you wanted to mention something as well.
Yeah, correct. Remember, the question from a Fourth Amendment perspective is whether or not a reasonable police officer would have believed that there was behavior or objective evidence that would lead that person to reach the conclusion that they had to use force to protect themselves or somebody else from imminent bodily injury or serious death. The existence of whether or not Mr. Scott had TBI is an interesting question, but the real question is not the cause of the behavior, but what was the behavior? And again, the videotape just does not help us answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you, Jason Huber, Professor Huber from Charlotte School of Law. Stand by with us along with our reporters Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn this afternoon. I'm Mark Rumsey. You're listening to special All Things Considered coverage of events and developments today surrounding this week's fatal police shooting of Keith Scott. Our reporter David Borax is here as well in the studio. He went to a press conference this afternoon with some black business owners along North Tryon Street. David, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks, Mark.
This event was organized by Sean Corbett. Is that correct? And who is he?
That's right. Some people may know him as the organizer of a group called Cops and Barbers, but this was about a lot more than just that organization. You know, this shooting and the aftermath has really hit the black community hard here, and it's not just the shooting. It's the protests afterwards that have cast a shadow on the black community, and you know, watching this on TV every night is kind of sending a signal to the country about what kind of a place we are. So we had the release of this video today shot by Keith Scott's wife, but that's really not what these folks came to talk about today. It was more of a long view about the black community, and it was trying to send a message that the black community isn't one group and what they can be doing themselves. You know, I've been talking to people all week who really want to help change the perceptions. And so Sean Corbett talked about his efforts today to bring the community together. It was introspective. You know, he talked about how the black community needs to help itself and build networks.
Last night I had a community meeting here, right here at the shop, that consisted of over 60 small businesses, community leaders, social workers, nonprofit organizers, just to figure out how to move forward and bring peace and calm to our city in trying times. So here are some of the things that we came up with. First of all, stop letting the media spin and falsely report what's going on in our community, which includes social media and mainstream media. Moving forward, let's get all the facts before we make our decision. Secondly, let's focus on supporting each other within our own communities, because if you look deeper, we have the resources and outlets within our own community to make the change that we need. Thirdly, let's focus on policing ourselves and our community. Support the small businesses that are in your community, because we are the ones that give these events to give back to our communities. And lastly, the importance of your local elections, which is your local government. Not only do we need to rebuild relationships with our law enforcement, but we need to build relationships with our local government.
David Sean Corbett there talked about building a network.
That's right. You know, he said people shouldn't get caught up in their emotions so much, and that at moments like this, it's really important for people to have a sense of community and a network to rely on. I also talked to somebody called Chanel Ketchmore. She runs a nonprofit network called Catch More Kids, and she had the same thought on her mind.
It's about we the people and the power that we have with our elected officials. If they're not being transparent, if they are not holding those that need to be held accountable, and if they're not making sure that the rights of everybody, all of us, we the people, are being protected, then we have the power to change that, you know?
So Ketchmore talked about where that power comes from, and she said it's all about building community. She sort of echoed Sean Corbett there. Here's what she had to say about that.
The networking is important because there is no I in team, and we have to do this together. We've all, you know, different fractions trying to be, you know, doing your thing, but separately. And so that connectedness is power in numbers, is power in resources.
So with Sean Corbett this afternoon was this group of African-American business owners, not just along North Tryon Street, but from across the city. And they were all there to talk to us about what they're thinking right now and how they think things need to go as we go forward. One of the ones I talked to was Paris Hopkins. She's connected with Sean Corbett's group for about the past year after her cousin, Janisha Fonville, was also killed by a police officer. She's been speaking around the city ever since, calling for justice. But she's also urging people in the community to take control, and she wants people outside her community to know that the violence you see on TV doesn't represent African Americans in Charlotte.
I want to see our black community start trusting each other more, relying on each other more. You know, just being a positive force in the community, and I feel like we have this bad stigma about us, like we're all nothing and don't want anything. It's like, that's not where we come from. Like, half of us is college educated.
And David, did Sean Corbett or any others in the group there today say anything about the video that was released by Keith Scott's family members that we've been discussing today?
Good question. We did ask Corbett for his thoughts about the video, and while it wasn't at the top of his mind, he did echo what many people are saying.
My feelings were the same that they were yesterday and the day before. I need to see the video from the police department.
So even in this group, which is working, you know, in a positive, peaceful way to bring about change over the long term, there's a pretty strong feeling that police ought to release the dash cam and body cam videos that they took Tuesday when Keith Scott was shot to death.
WFAE reporter David Borax, thanks very much. It's about 6 minutes to five, and we're continuing with a special hour of coverage here during All Things Considered on WFAE surrounding developments in the fatal police shooting this week of Keith Scott in Charlotte. I'm joined in the studio. I'm Mark Rumsey, joined in the studio by our reporters Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn, also Professor Jason Huber from the Charlotte School of Law. I'm going to play another portion, the middle portion of that two-minute video that was released by Keith Scott's family members and attorneys this afternoon. For those who may just be joining us, this is a part of what we're discussing, and so many here in Charlotte and around the nation are discussing this newly released cell phone video coming in advance of any release of the police body or dash cam videos. I do want to make you aware that this segment of the video, as the others, is graphic. And this does include the sound of the gunshots there on the scene in North Charlotte on Tuesday afternoon.
Keith, don't let them break the windows. Come on out the car.
Drop the gun.
Keith, don't do it.
Drop the gun.
Keith, get out the car. Keith, Keith, don't you do it. Don't you do it. Keith, 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 don't you do it. Did you shoot him? Did you shoot him? Did you shoot him? He better not be dead. He better not be dead. I know that much. I know that much. He better not be dead. I'm not going to come near you. I'm going to record, though. I'm not coming near you. I'm going to record, though. He better be alive because I'm coming. You better be alive.
So the portion of the very extremely emotional video released by the family of Keith Scott today from the Tuesday shooting in North Charlotte. It's hard to listen to. It comes at a time when there's this intensifying call for CMPD to release the official police videos of the incident. And as we've been discussing this afternoon, there are so many questions raised by what we can hear in the recording and the video itself, which is available in numerous places, including our website, WFAE.org, raises questions perhaps more than it answers them as well. I'm joined in the studio right now by Tom Bullock and Gwendolyn Glenn, along with Professor Jason Huber of the Charlotte School of Law. We've got just a few minutes here during this hour of special coverage. What do you think, Tom, will be a takeaway or possibly a pivotal aspect of this video being released today?
That's the big question, especially heading into tonight. As soon as we heard that we were going to see video, and this video was not released to the CMPD until it was released pretty much to everyone because Mr. Scott's widow says she doesn't trust the police, so she released it to the media first. The first thing I did to try to get a sense of what this means for Charlotte is hop on social media, and it's not good. A lot of people see there a lot of reason to blame the police. Again, I encourage people to take a look, to talk about it, to see what they see themselves, because there's a lot of questions in this. It's one of the reasons we're talking about it in this special coverage, because we're trying to get to what we do know and what we don't know about this instead of just having rumors. But I think it's going to be a tenser night. I know everybody is hoping for it to be as peaceful as it was last night. We'll have to wait and see on that one. But I'm sure that their police presence is going to increase, and I'm sure that there's going to be more protest presence as well.
Professor Huber, you've talked over the past hour several times about the Fourth Amendment issues here. What do you think that people should take away, or how do we view that based on what we can and can't know from this video?
I think that's exactly right. We just don't know at this point from a Fourth Amendment perspective concerning whether or not the lethal use of force was reasonable. It's important that we take our time and get all the facts, both video, witness statements, documentary evidence, whatever evidence they may be out there that can help the police department and help the community make a reasonable determination concerning what occurred.
And Gwendolyn Glenn, you've been following this story from Tuesday night. You were in the field providing one of our very earliest reports after the shooting and when the protest began to erupt. What are your thoughts, having come through this week of protests and all of this talk about videos?
Well, again, there are a lot of questions, even with the video. There are a lot of questions that are still yet to be answered. And one thing that I picked up in talking with a lot of people. There is a thing of trust, as Tom said, and you heard the mayor and other city officials saying this is not Charlotte and what we've been seeing with some of the protests. But what I've been hearing people say is that city officials do not know a large segment of Charlotte's population and what really is Charlotte. And I think that's what's frustrating for them. And a lot of them are saying they feel as if they are not being heard and that they want to get the attention of city officials. So a lot of questions, and we don't know what's going to happen tonight.
Gwendolyn, thank you very much. WFAE reporter Gwendolyn Glenn. I've also been joined by our reporter Tom Bullock. And thank you also to Professor Jason Huber of the Charlotte School of Law for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
To our guest who joined us by phone as well. Just about 5 o'clock, and this has been special coverage on All Things Considered here on 90.7 WFAE Charlotte and 90.3 WFHE Hickory. We're celebrating 35 years as Charlotte's NPR news source. I'm Mark Rumsey. Much more of All Things Considered from NPR just ahead.